We do appreciate all of our local loyal listeners. And here we go with James Baldwin and Where We Are At.
What is relevant about this is that whereas 40 years ago when I was born, the question of having to deal with what is unspoken by the subjugated, what is never said to the master, of having to deal with this reality was a very remote possibility. It was in no one's mind. When I was growing up, I was taught in American history books that Africa had no history, and neither did I. That I was a savage, about whom the less said the better, who had been saved by Europe and brought to America. And of course, I believed it. I didn't have much choice. Those were the only books there were. Everyone else seemed to agree. If you walk out of Harlem, ride out of Harlem, downtown, the world agrees. What you see is much bigger, cleaner, whiter, richer, safer than where you are. They collect the garbage. People obviously can pay their life insurance. The children look happy, safe. You're not. And you go back home. And it would seem then, of course, that it's an act of God, that this is true, that you belong where white people have put you. It is only since the Second World War that there's been a counter image in the world. And that image has not come about through any legislation on the part of any American government, but through the fact that Africa was suddenly on the stage of the world, and Africans had to be dealt with in a way they'd never been dealt with before. This gave an American Negro, for the first time, a sense of himself beyond a savage or a clown. It has created, and will create, a great many conundrums. One of the great things that the white world does not know, but I think I do know, is that black people are just like everybody else. One has used the myth of Negro and the myth of color to pretend and to assume that you are dealing essentially with something exotic, bizarre, and practically, according to human laws, unknown. Alas, it is not true. We are also mercenaries, dictators, murderers, liars. We are human too. What is crucial here is that unless we can manage to establish some kind of dialogue between those people whom I pretend have paid for the American dream and those other people who have not achieved it, we will be in terrible trouble. I want to say at the end, the last, is that that is what concerns me most. We are sitting in this room and we are all, at least we like to think we are, relatively civilized, and we can talk to each other at least on certain levels. So that we could walk out of here assuming that the measure of our enlightenment, or at least our politeness, has some effect on the world. It may not. I remember, for example, when the ex-Attorney General, Mr. Robert Kennedy, said that it was conceivable that in 40 years in America we might have a Negro president. And that sounded like a very emancipated statement, I suppose, to white people. They were not in Harlem when this statement was first heard, and did not hear, and possibly will never hear, the laughter and the bitterness and the scorn with which the statement was greeted. From the point of view of the man in the Harlem barbershop, Bobby Kennedy only got here yesterday. And now he's already on his way to the presidency. We've been here for 400 years, and now he tells us that maybe in 40 years, if you're good, we may let you become president. What is dangerous here is the turning away from anything any white American says. The reason for the political hesitation in spite of the Johnson landslide is that one has been betrayed by American politicians for so long. And I'm a grown man, and perhaps I can be reasoned with. I certainly hope I can be. But I don't know, and neither does Martin Luther King, none of us know, how to deal with those other people whom the white world has so long ignored, who don't believe anything the white world says, and don't entirely believe anything I or Martin say. And one can't blame them. You watch what has happened to them in less than 20 years. It seems to me that the city of New York, for example, this is my last point, which had Negroes in it for a very long time. If the city of New York were able, as it has indeed been able, in the last 15 years to reconstruct itself, tear down buildings and raise great new ones, downtown and for money, and has done nothing whatever except build housing projects in the ghetto for the Negroes. And of course the Negroes hate it. Presently the property does indeed deteriorate because the children cannot bear it. They want to get out of the ghetto. If the American pretensions were based on more solid, a more honest assessment of life and of themselves, it would not mean for Negroes, when someone says urban renewal, that Negroes simply are going to be thrown out into the streets, which is what it does mean now. This is not an act of God. We're dealing with a society made and ruled by men. If the American Negro had not been president in America, I am convinced that the history of the American labor movement would be much more edifying than it is. It is a terrible thing for an entire people to surrender to the notion that 1/9 of its population is beneath them. And until that moment, until the moment comes when we, the American people, are able to accept the fact that I have to accept, for example, that my ancestors are both white and black, that on that continent we are trying to forge a new identity for which we need each other, and that I am not a ward of America. I am not an object of missionary charity. I am one of the people who built the country. Until this moment, there is scarcely any hope for the American dream, because the people who are denied participation in it, by their very presence, will wreck it. And if that happens, it's a very grave moment for the West. Thank you.
That was James Baldwin and the his speech he gave during, well, what's considered his pin drop speech on that he gave during a debate at the University of Cambridge on February 18th, 1965. Yesterday was the anniversary of James Baldwin's death. Actually, he was born August 2nd, 1924 in Harlem, New York. And he died December 1st, 1987. And so I just wanted to kind of start today's programming as I got a little bit ready. Got here just a nick of time from Springfield. And we'll talk perhaps a little bit more about that. I do have a guest with me. His name is Alan Axelrod. He is the campaign manager of Stephanie Frank Smith, who is a perhaps today now officially a candidate for the 13th congressional district. She's running as a Democrat candidate. So, Alan, can you talk a little bit about yourself? Of course, some couple things going on right now with, of course, with what I just said and what's going on tonight at the Urbana City Council meeting at 7 p.m.
Absolutely. So, as you mentioned, name's Alan Axelrod, and I'm the campaign manager for Stephanie Smith. Her campaign has been a wild ride in that this is something that the establishment does not exactly have a frame of reference for, and we're not intending to provide one. So when we talk tonight, we're going to be talking mostly about what has happened that we can talk about publicly, and we're also going to be talking about what sort of things we can do to be in solidarity with the working and marginalized classes. It's a very hard act to follow with the introductory speech that we had listened to, but I'll try.
Yeah, and with so we'll kind of get as much into that as you can, because I know as, but of course with what's going on in about less than an hour at the Urbana City Council, there is a kind of a, and this was kind of this was talked about last. It was sort of mentioned. It was kind of like this is something that's up to debate, and this is was. I guess you would say introduced last week about financing mm-hmm. Putting funds for to that would essentially put police in Urbana schools.
Yeah, so the main thing is that there's been an intergovernmental agreement brokered between the Urbana School District 116 and the Urbana City Council. This has in part to do both with safety concerns at the school board and also to do with budgetary issues for the Urbana City Council. And that is not to legitimize what is happening at all. It's important to understand the motivations of the people involved in order to be able to speak to them in a way that they will listen. So far, the indication that we've been listened to has basically been evinced by the fact that instead of the Urbana City Council deciding to push through this agreement like the Urbana School District did, they actually said, wait a second, we might have jumped the gun here and instead need to try to have some of the concerns that have been expressed by the community addressed. And so tonight at the city council meeting, we're going to find out how well the Urbana Police Department does their homework, because Jared Miller, as well as other members of the Urbana City Council, provided a laundry list of things that they believed needed to happen in order for them to vote yes on the school resource officer's proposal. And I am, in disclosure, against that agreement, because for the amount of money that's being proposed, about $230,000 from the Urbana School District and about an additional $100,000 from Urbana City Council, we could fund a small army of social workers, and we could probably provide better services to those who are in most dire poverty. I don't recall seeing rich kids having any sort of issues similar to what we're seeing in communities of poverty. And because the confluence of poverty and the systemic racism that we have in our community, this basically means that we are going to be over-policing schools where there are going to be Black youth in poverty who are not provided the resources to process their trauma proactively and instead funnel them into the school-to-prison pipeline. So the main thing that the City Council will be discussing tonight is, again, how well the Police Department has done their homework as directed by the City Council, and then they would intend to pass the buck back to the Urbana School District for a final decision on how to go about this. And it's a little discouraging that it's gotten this far, even though the Urbana City Council has listened to us in the first pass, because the thing is that the research around why school resource officers is an inefficient way to address these concerns is preponderous. And there is an open letter that was signed by dozens of Urbana School District parents that expressed this and provided that research. And on top of that, the counterpoints were of two varieties. They were either from organizations representing school resource officers or police, or they were categorical denials of the validity of the concerns brought by members of the community by saying, you're not a teacher, you're not a parent, you're not a category that I deem relevant to this discussion, when those folks might be better read on the issue. So the main thing that we're going to be seeing tonight is whether or not that practice continues and is given an air of validity, rather than actually addressing the points expressed.
And I believe last week, when this was introduced, there was a lot of course, people were very outspoken on it. I met, from what I understood, it was very against this, because I believe it, the meeting last Monday went beyond the usual meeting, and I think it went well into the night over at past 10 p.m. So it seems like, people are very, not exactly excited about this proposal of putting funds with police in schools and in Urbana schools. So do you know if they will come to a vote tonight, if possible?
Well, so I believe that there was a discussion about whether or not to hold a vote the preceding week, when they then said, okay, next week we'll vote on it because of the discussion held today. I'm unaware as to whether or not there was a vote last week specifically on that, because as we mentioned, it was a long city council meeting. One thing, though, to also point out is that there are a lot of folks who are sympathetic with the views being expressed as to why not have a school resource officer, who actually are pro having a school resource officer added to the school budget. And that usually comes from the teachers are saying that they need this. And the actual thing that is being expressed there is the teachers in school and the staff in school say that for one reason or another, things are not right. They don't feel safe. It's important to therefore make sure that we respond in a way that's backed by empiricism rather than as a basically high-cost placebo effect. Last time I checked, a placebo does not cost $330,000 with a possible annual budgetary commitment without the category for de-escalation. However, that is what the folks who are empathetic to the concerns of the teachers have been supportive of, at least tacitly. So it's important to inoculate against that when we continue the discussion. But yeah, the main thing is that there is an expected vote tonight on it, and I hope that they again listen to the community when these concerns are continued in their expression, and we get to see how well the Urbana Police Department does their homework.
And you've been, I imagine you've been talking to people in the community, getting organized and talking to people around how they've been feeling as you've been talking about. You're trying to get as many people to the city council, participant, at the very least, listening to what's going on. And if you could kind of talk about that.
Well, so the first thing to admit publicly is that this is very much a short notice organizing effort. This is not something where we're like, the full force of the Champaign-Urbana community is going to be brought to bear at city council. That rarely, if ever, happens. And on top of that, while managing a congressional campaign who had a deadline today, it's been very difficult to manage that when jumping around multiple cities and having people drive other people who have just barely met to make sure that those deadlines were met. So the main thing is that we are an imperfect group of people trying to do as best as we can by the community. And the number of folks who are able to show up, those are the folks who just happen to be both supportive, of course, but also lucky. Lucky that they're not working a food service job during that time. Lucky that they don't have to worry about childcare during that time. Lucky that they have the means for transportation, either through their own economic happenstance or through their existing network, to make it to a city council meeting rather than only watching it online, which, by the way, you can do. If you type hard enough onto Google, you should be able to find an Urbana live stream where you will be able to view the city council meeting. And if you were to, say, hypothetically message on Facebook or post on Facebook or Twitter tagging the Urbana City Council and or representatives, they would actually know that you are there watching and listening. And I think that that's important, not from a sort of public pressure perspective, although that might have an effect, but to make sure that our representatives have the information they need to be representative.
And I know last week Stephanie Frank Smith spoke at the Urbana. She spoke about it, and of course she spoke about how she was concerned about, yes, this type of having this type of funding going to police and putting police in our schools. She's also spoke about she spoke at the, was it Bloomington?
Yes.
City council meaning. I mean, she's essentially doing her best to get her, you know, make her presence known both at the local level, and that she's paying attention to what's kind of, can you kind of talk about that and how,
so the first thing is to draw a distinction. When Stephanie makes the effort to go to these public meetings, these are not at all reaches for publicity. It is not easy for someone with agoraphobia to talk in front of other people and to say, these are things that you should be paying attention to. So it's worth people knowing that if she's at a meeting, she is there despite accessibility needs, despite wellness needs, in sacrifice, in service to an issue that she wishes to speak about. In particular, last week, she spoke about to the Urbana City Council how the involvement with the criminal justice system is one of the leading risk factors for children to actually be sexually exploited, whether that is sex trafficking or later engaged in survival sex or sex work thereof. That's not exactly an industry that she recommends people go to, but when people feel that is their only safe option, there's a trajectory that has led them to that conclusion. And part of that trajectory does involve contact with the criminal justice system. It also may involve things like involvement with the foster care system as two of the leading causes. So she was there saying, what are you doing? You are making this more likely to happen. And on top of that, this isn't even the only thing going on in the city of Urbana that has increased the risk of these kind of things. She went on to explain that there are businesses in the community as well as nonprofit spaces that have a combination of actually promoting child sexual work, which is not good, to say the least. But the other thing is that there are organizations with conflicts of interest or a lack of resources that are supporting those businesses. And so that was the main thing that she was expressing last week at Urbana City Council, because that's something that no one else was going to talk about. Everybody was going to talk about why they didn't feel that we should be spending a combined $330,000 between two governmental entities. But no one was going to talk about things that related to her lived experience, because most of the people who are able to don't have that lived experience. It takes a lot to overcome what she's overcome to be able to speak publicly about it. So hopefully we will be able to have more conversations like that, where we can talk about issues of survival for people in poverty, for women in poverty, for LGBTQ youth in poverty, for people of color in poverty, and to basically just say to those public bodies the most dire things that they should be paying attention to. So again, it's not a publicity stunt. It's not something that we're like, hey, it's a Tuesday night, let's go visit this local unit of government. This is something that has severe impacts on survivors' mental health. And the fact that we have a government, or in this case, two governmental units, that is making decisions that leads to these kind of outcomes speaks to the dire need to increase accessibility in politics so that we can attain some level of equality in how we practice policy.
And I'm not sure how much time you have left, because I know you've got that council meeting that you're going to be driving to. Can you kind of tell, and of course, you know, today was, as we just mentioned, you know, kind of the last day of filing for candidates running for office. Can you kind of I don't know. How much time do you have? I don't
know. Well, so as far as time goes, I am willing to, unlike most folks, I'm willing to arrive late to a city council meeting because you could submit your card whenever you please. You can speak before the agenda item is introduced. You can speak when the agenda item is introduced. So it's not terribly important to be on time to a city council meeting. However, Urbana City Council does start their public comment in the beginning, unlike Champaign City Council, different story. So I'm willing to stay to have this conversation flushed out. I think I might have mentioned to a few folks that some details about this would happen after 6:30. So I'm willing to stay to make that happen. It just depends whether or not anybody says, hey, Alan, willing to come, need a ride, ASAP, please. If someone says that, yes, I would leave to make sure that that person has the ability to express themselves in front of their representatives.
And I guess you would, really, of course, call this a grassroots campaign. Just kind of to get, I didn't actually get to ask this to Stephanie, I don't think, when she was on here about kind of like how she came to the decision. Because when you were looking for a candidate to run for for the 13th congressional district that you felt like really needed to represent, what you just talked about, people, working class people, people of color, the LGBT community, people that have really, unfortunately, kind of people that live on SNAP benefits, people that are really kind of just struggling to get back. Can you kind of tell to me how you came across Stephanie and how she just decided, I'm up for, to run for the 13th congressional district?
Absolutely. Well, the first thing is there's a dearth of humility in organizing, so I cannot take credit for starting a search effort, for being part of a search effort. This was a multi-county effort, and that's one thing that no one has reported on. It has come to numerous folks' attention that we were in for a repeat of 2020 with more dire, of 2018's midterm election locally, but with more dire consequences on the docket. There wasn't necessarily an expectation of having a stronger platform. There was actually a ton of intimidation along the way that prevented us from presenting a candidate earlier. It just so happened that I was one of the folks who happened to interact with Stephanie when it came time to say, this is zero hour. Can you be a part of this? And so when I asked, I'll back up for a second and first say how I first met Stephanie, and it has to do with the art theater. See, the art theater announced recently that it's closing its doors, and people need to understand a bit of the background as to why and how that relates to Stephanie's campaign. So this past summer, a transphobic movie creator was provided a platform by a so-called leftist, a so-called anti-war activist, a so-called human rights advocate. A human rights advocate would never support anybody who is transphobic. Trans folks have a 50% suicide attempt rate. We know folks vulnerable in this community who are struggling now. So in the process of me coming across that was happening, that was happening this past summer, I just saw it on a community email list. I decided to give some pushback as to the entire notion of that being a valid thing in a very dispassionate, factual way. And then I received a very lengthy email response saying that I was somehow a lead organizer of this whole blacklist effort, which, first off, the distinction between a blacklist and a boycott acknowledges the power or lack thereof of the people participating. If they are oppressing you, it's a blacklist. If it is a group of people who are with lesser systemic power, it is a boycott. So this person was conflating boycott and blacklist, knowing the difference, knowing that it was explained to him multiple times, and then accusing me of being the lead organizer, to which I responded internally, there are other people who are organizing on this. That is the most beautiful thing ever. I need to meet these people. Stephanie was one of those people. So in the process of organizing with the folks who would later become the CU Trans Empowerment Network, or CUTENET. I got to learn more about Stephanie. I got to learn that she was actually interning at the same office as me. I got to learn about her background. And when the search effort was, you know, more than half over, and I was starting to look to who I knew locally that could be viable, I did talk to Stephanie about it. We were right outside of Rick's Bakery, and there, I didn't know it at the time. She thought I was joking when I asked, because she knows that I knew she was a former sex worker, a child survival sex worker. She knew that I knew this, and she also knew a little bit about how I try to practice in the community as just someone who cares, and she still thought that maybe I was playing some sort of joke cruelly. And I mean, that's something that I didn't realize until months later, but I didn't give up on her. And when it came time to 0 hour, the weekend before Labor Day, when I had a call, I actually did not expect her to say yes. I honor it when people say no. People need to respect other people's no's more than they currently do. But in the event that we actually needed to present a less than ideal candidate for the organizing effort that had been pursued for almost a half year by that point, we needed to make sure that every box has been checked, that every person who could lead this effort has been approached. And when I got to Stephanie, she said yes, but, and that terrified me, because that was the weekend before Labor Day. Almost everybody's expecting a candidate to have announced by then. Yes, but I need to talk to my kid first. And I didn't know the conversation at the time with her kid. She told me later. It basically went down like this. She said, "You could be told in school, on the news, in social media, that your mother's a whore." Daughter responds, "I don't care. I love you." Stephanie continues, "There could be death threats. This is uncharted territory." Daughter responds, "The trans woman who threw the first brick at Stonewall, that was uncharted territory." That's a reflection of Stephanie as a mother. Her kid is amazing. So, anywho, that's how the campaign came to be. She dressed as a goth Waldo at the Labor Day parade to let me know that we have finally found Waldo, that we have finally found someone with lived experience who has the courage to run what most people would consider career-wise a suicide mission, to stand for issues of poverty in an overwhelmingly poor district.
And just to remind you, you're listening to WFT Champagne, of course, 90.1 FM. And of course, since this is quite a heavy topic, and that, and of course, with what's going on today with the meeting coming up, and a reminder that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign, Prairie Air Incorporated, station management, the board of directors, or the WEFT associates. But I'm trying to think, you know, with this kind of, you know, finally wrapping up, you know, or with, oh, no, I'm sorry, what can you kind of say what's been the reaction to, because you've been, you know, obviously canvassing, getting petition signatures. You kind of lead in with about talking about the ban on rent control. That's kind of like your strategy. You've been kind of your strategy to kind of say, you know, of course, we have this ban on rent control. And then if you're, and you ask people how they feel about that, if they're supportive of that, you say, well, there is Stephanie Smith, who is supportive of lifting the ban on This is just kind of one of your strategies, so we can kind of talk about that.
So again, humility in organizing. That wasn't me. That was born out of months and months and months of conversations with different groups who have amazing issues-based work, but no time for electoralism, and I sympathize with that. And so what we did was we came up with a strategy where, regardless of our involvement in electoralism, it would serve pushing issues that our communities need the most. And that is to also segue to any candidate who ever wants to emulate this model or who wants to be a benefactor of the folks who are on this model. There are a bunch of things that need to happen first. That's something that if folks are interested, they can talk to me about. But fundamentally, there's a three-step approach, because we want to make sure if anybody else tries to emulate this approach through astroturfing or through lip service, that they do a job on informing folks about the issues that moneyed lobbies do not want them hearing about. So the first step is we present an issue that significantly and tangibly impacts the quality of life of the person that we're living, that is living at the door that we are knocking or is at the bus stop that we are canvassing. And we say to them at a high level, basically, hey, here's a moment of class solidarity. Your rent is too high. You don't have real access to healthcare. It's not affordable despite how it's branded. Your housing is not affordable despite how it's branded. You don't have access to mental health care or social services to process your trauma proactively. Talking to people about those issues, depending on when we schedule each one of those issues-based activities, asking them to sign a petition to leave their mark on that issue so that we can approach representatives and say, a lot of people care about this. Please do the right thing or find a way to. Even if you stand for it and you can't act, find a way. And so the second step is we regularly organize on this issue. Would you like to join us? Yes, maybe no. And the reason for that is because the sweat that people exert organizing needs to be reciprocated in order for it to be a real movement. Otherwise, it's a couple people angrily on a corner. I've seen that. It doesn't work all that well, but it is respectable. The thing is that after that step, we have now a growing volunteer pool to work on these issues, to push representatives on these issues in a compassionate way where we are trying to build community in the process. And then the third step, this is the secret ingredient, so to speak, is to seasonally inject electoralism. That is to say, if it's non-electoral season, we're still going to canvass like this. We're going to do it year-round because these issues are literally that serious. It is life and death for some people. And then when it is election season, we add that leverage to the docket. We say, thank you so much for signing on this issue, agreeing to volunteer on this issue. Here's a list of candidates who endorse this policy move that we've been talking about. So that is to say, if someone wants to be listed on that, they have to speak publicly about it, substantively. If someone wants to be listed on that and have volunteers from certain campaigns help them, there has to be a conversation there. And the reason for that is because that's going to stand in stark contrast to any sort of half measures taken there. If I just print up a random sheet of folks and say, these people back it, people are going to try to fact check that. People actually do. People in politics tend to deride folks who are engaged in politics as being less than informed. Apathy is not the cause of folks not engaging in the way that people idealize. Trauma is. From poverty, from actual abuse. So these folks ultimately will do their research. Someone left Restoration Urban Ministries 2 days ago, and I was walking down downtown Champaign, said to me, I Googled Stephanie Smith. I love her, and I'm going to vote for her. That is someone who is housing insecure, who no one would have otherwise engaged with because they're not going to be on VAN. They're not going to be on a Democratic Party database. They're not going to be on a Republican Party database. They're not even going to be on a third party database. These are people who actually need to be reached out to, who are the overwhelming majority in the district. 60% of the district in a given year is eligible for the food assistance program known as SNAP, and that's because it's a monthly eligibility criteria. When we have a district that skewed, and we still have only wealthy people engaging in politics with that lens, they're going to miss the huge upswell of support that can actually be garnered. So if someone makes a bunch of lists of folks that have not spoken publicly on that issue, good luck to them. That's going to result in disorganizing conduct. People are going to Google that and find out that you've lied. So that's the strategy behind organizing currently. We do invite organizations to have a fourth step, which is to also say, please join our organization. We're involved in this and so much more. Because the thing is that there should be a benefit to being involved in your community for different organizations and agendas. And there is to an extent, but I would argue it's inaccessible right now. How do we make that more accessible? This is just one hypothetically, or this is one hypothesis as to how to do this. So, you know, if we're wrong, we'll adjust. And I think that more people need to try something like this, or maybe if they don't try something like this, but they are inspired in some particular way to support it in what way they can, because it is ableist to say, go and door knock as the only action. So we're also providing folks the ability to remotely organize in a similar fashion. That we're still building out tutorials for, but that is something that's on the docket. I do want to go back to the jail if I can, though, because, sure. Oh, sorry, not the jail, the school resource school. Officer, yeah. Because I did say to the YDSA, hi guys, if you're listening, folks, that I would talk about it after 6:30. So the main thing to just rehash a few points is that there's an intergovernmental agreement that has been negotiated over the past couple weeks, if not longer, between the Urbana School District 116 and the Urbana City Council. When two governmental bodies make an intergovernmental agreement, that is huge for their relationship going forward. So that means it's going to be very, very difficult to actually interject in this process. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't try. So part of the reason why that makes it difficult is because governments expect consistent and reliable partnerships with each other. The point that I was there to make at Urbana City Council last week is that the focus should not be on reliable and consistent relationships with different units of government, although that is a bonus. It should be first and foremost reliable and consistent relationships with the people they represent. And so part of what we're hoping folks will do is basically say to the Urbana City Council, thank you for listening to us last week. We're concerned that even with those measures proposed, that it's not enough. And to then propose that we have at least an increase in the number of guidance counselors or in the number of social workers involved in the school system. Because the thing is, this is a pretty huge step that's being taken. It's a pretty huge step that's being taken out of the apparent urgency and fear related to incidences in school, people finding bullets in a bathroom. That is scary. That means that people had a gun there, and that means people had ammo for that gun, most likely. The fact of the matter is, if they are committed to getting school resource officers, we should do everything we can to make sure that at least some of that revenue is diverted so that there are constructive solutions that we can measure against, that we can do a comparative after-the-fact analysis, as opposed to only trying one option and only measuring the efficacy or lack thereof of one option. If we're really serious about an issue, we shouldn't be fully invested in one dubiously valid way of going about it. And the reason I say dubiously valid is because there is research saying, hey, look, this works. The reason that it's dubious is from where, is because of where that research is from. Again, it is from organizations that support school resource officers. It is from organizations that are backed by police. And so that is not to say that they're evil. I know some people will say that. It is to say that there are conflicts of interest in the systemic set of issues that we are going to be engaging with tonight, and that should be recognized in a substantive way. So that's basically the briefing that I wanted to make sure, if possible, that at least members of YDSA could hear about. But that's a rehashing of a topic that folks who had been listening this entire time have heard of. So at that point, I'm definitely willing to pivot to maybe even resuming a conversation about the campaign or talking about just activism in general and how it's been going in town.
Sure. Let me just read a few kind of PSAs that we usually have. I'll be really quick. WFT programming is made possible by Kranitz Center for the Performing Arts presenting the Nutcracker on December 5th, 6th, 7th, and 8th. Champaign Urbana Ballet and the Champaign Urbana Symphony Orchestra return for 6 performances of this magical family-friendly holiday classic set to Tchaikovsky's beloved score. Of course, for more information, you can visit kranertcenter.com. That's Kranert Center. That's KRANERTCENTER.com. And I'm just going to kind of briefly glance through this. I apologize, but it's just we have a little bit of time. There's the with it being winter, with being winter, as you can tell, it's getting very, very cold. There is the Champaign Emergencies winter shelter available through April 15th. There is some resources available. Unfortunately, not food. Or only about light snacks are available. For more information on the men's shelter, you can contact Aletha Keith. The phone number is 217-819-5469. After business hours, the phone number is 217-888-0329. There is also the Champaign Women's Emergency Shelter, known as Austin's Place, that is also available through April 15th of 2020 between the hours of 7:30 p.m. and 7 a.m. That's located on 504 East Church Street in Champaign. Transportation to the shelter is available at First United Methodist Church, provided by volunteers. Again, some light snacks are available, but no meals, no showers or laundry. Guests are provided bus tokens in the morning. And for more information, you can call Ruth Moore at 317-356-9078. After business hours, the phone number is 217-888-0329. And there's also St. Andrew's Church, located at 909 South Wright Street. Showers are available for women there, I believe, on Tuesday and Friday from 10:30 a.m. to 2 p.m. During the Austin's Place operating seasons. And, of course, you're listening to WFT Champaign 90.1 FM. And, of course, you can stream us online at WFT.org. And, of course, I just want to make it clear that the views and opinions expressed on air are solely those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of WFT Champaign Prairie Air Incorporated, Station Management, the Board of Directors, or the WFT Associates. As we got just about a little less than 10 minutes or so, Alan, finalizing these, or turning into your signatures, mm-hmm. Whether or not we'll see what happens if it gets challenged or, you know, because I know that can sometimes happen. Is there anything else you want to kind of talk about this whole experience, this camp, before you talk about what's going forward, if there's anything you feel the need for people to know?
Well, the first thing to know is that it's incredibly easy to become a candidate, and that more people should be looking into what those numbers look like in order to ensure that folks who might be playing games when it comes to strategic demonstrations of listening to the community as we express our concerns, that their power base is actually very brittle. And that is to say that today we filed precinct committee folks in Macon County. We filed a precinct committee person in Champaign County, and that was exceptionally easy. And there are abilities that being a precinct committee person has that could actually result in some degree of change. That said, we also have filed a county board member for, well, I'll leave the district a secret because I don't want his mom to find out just yet, or at least he doesn't want his mom to find out just yet. So the point is that it's exceptionally easy to create candidates. It's exceptionally easy to substantively organize and meet people where they're at, especially when no one else is doing it. We've knocked on doors that no one else has knocked on in years. Not just one election cycle, multiple. And that's because people actually do think of folks as resources rather than trying to organize and motivate people and inspire people to do good by their community. And so the main thing that I think people need to realize is that you don't have to wait for that poli-sci degree to start trying to affect change in your community. You can start by door knocking by yourself. I did that for Lift the Ban on Rent Control. And then I went up to the Champaign-Urbana DSA after a month of doing that by myself. Said, hey, I'm door knocking to lift the ban on rent control. Let me tell you why. There was a non-member in the room of the Champaign-Urbana DSA who listened to me talk about why I was working to lift the ban on rent control, and I can say why in a little bit after I finish the anecdote. That person signed an interest card. That is a way of joining the Champaign-Urbana DSA right then and there. You don't need buy-in from anybody to start trying to make a change in your community. You just need to start, if you can, by yourself, and then to try to talk to people about why you are trying to do what you're doing alone in hopes that someone will join you. And if not, maybe you pivot on how you're doing that. But if people join, maybe you are onto something there and maybe you should keep going. In Decatur, they have a city council that has rejected sales revenue from cannabis sales as a way of trying to financially strangle their community and also over-police their community. That is why both socialists and libertarians and centrists have all teamed up to do an advisory referendum that takes thousands of petition signatures to get. So there can be flashpoints. There can be things that you find out by yourself. But you got to try in order to figure that out. The reason that I organized on lifting the ban on rent control, and everybody's got their reasons, is because I'm actually a really privileged person. I am working to what extent I can to try and shed some privilege, but that's never actually going to work. There are 37 states where mortgages are cheaper than rent. I actually have been privileged to the point that I can afford a mortgage. I have a mortgage on my home. I will be a homeowner without a mortgage before the age of 40. Unless if some financial catastrophe happens, of course. Insurance is a fun place to study. So looking at that and the fact that I've got that kind of security and that suddenly that's opened up the possibility for me engaging in a bunch of different ways that I didn't think I'd be able to do until I was maybe in retirement age. I'm looking at the fact that there's so many people who live paycheck to paycheck who can't do that, and how that's basically silencing a bunch of voices who are suffering the most. How the higher rent system that we have prevents people from being able to save money from participating in the housing market, so that even if one bought a home as a business venture, it's actually a sinking ship. It's still a sinking ship. The rental industry is the one that's been growing the most since 2008, not the home buying industry. So the reason that I got involved is because it is the source of silencing people. The protests in Puerto Rico and Sudan that were amazingly successful in deposing an intolerable leadership in a constructive way without the outbreak of mass violence, one of the things they had in common was a low cost of rent relative to the price of milk by the gallon. If someone has housing security, suddenly they're able to do a lot more advocacy for each other. And I think we need to fight for that. So, yeah, that's a spiel, I guess, on my involvement.
Okay, and in the last, I guess, but it's probably been my last question, kind of as I wrap this programming of where we are at. For people, you know, and I know we still got a few months, you know, just March 17th is the primary for Illinois. It's going to be I feel like with how 2016 and 2018 was, and of course with the media and how Paul, with Stephanie Frank Smith, this being her first, obviously being her first campaign, and I'm not sure how many candidates, other than I'm guessing Betsy Dirksen Lonergan looks like to be one of her candidates. I don't know who else, but what's something you would tell people at the very least they should look at about her that separates her from the usual candidate?
So Stephanie is someone who has been homeless to the point that it was normalized for her in her childhood. She is someone who has survived sexual assault and abuse. She is someone who has been food insecure, who has been in poverty most of her life. She has fallen through most of the holes in our social safety nets and is therefore an expert on how to close those gaps. She knows the inequalities in our civil court system that no one's talking about because they're so focused on only criminal justice. We can walk and chew gum at the same time, because this is something that's desperately affecting folks who have lower income with partners who have higher income. This is desperately affecting folks who can afford an attorney. And so the main thing is that she is someone who has the lived experience of the majority of our district, because it's overwhelmingly impoverished and poverty is violence.
All right, Alan, thank you so much for coming, and I thank you to those who are listening, and of course you can always listen. I believe we are archived at the whole show at wft.org, but I'm going to have to end the show here of where we are at. I'm just going to play Otis. I'm going to end playing out with Otis. Otis Redding, A Change Is Going to Come, from Super Brown Bear YouTube channel. That's the name of the YouTube channel. So, so this is Otis Redding, A Change Is Going to Come. Thank you very much for listening. Have a good night.
Thanks, Ben.